This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
And welcome to Birth to Work Radio with Elaine Scott, Rick Stevens, and our special Birth to Work guest today, Bill Scott, a veteran reporter, very highly decorated with lots of awards and distinctions for outstanding aviation news reporting. Today, a published author and also a gentleman with a new movie contract, which he's going to talk to us a little bit about. Bill, I want you to spend a little bit of time, if you would, at the top of this program, giving our audience a little bit about your background as a reporter, because you come from a perspective that has to do with someone who was all your life has been about reporting with a reason, not to earn a paycheck, but more to make a difference. And that transition from reporter to author is one that I think is a great interest to our listeners. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure can. Thanks, Elaine. It's good to be here with you and Rick. I should start by saying I'm not what I call a real reporter. I started life as an electrical engineer, then became a flight test engineer and tested airplanes for a good 12 years before I got into the reporter business and went to work for Aviation Week magazine, spent 22 years there in various roles from engineering editor to a national editor in Washington to Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief here in Colorado before I retired. One of the things that I learned and came to really enjoy as a reporter was this idea of telling stories. And as a reporter, you tell a story by first doing your reporting, gathering facts, and then always looking for what is the story, because you have a collection of facts and data, and they can take a story in any number of different directions, but always try to step back, take the big picture look, and say, what is the story? And as I became experienced, I always had the feeling that the story was there, it was out there, and it could tell itself, but my job was just to release it, put it in a form that obviously we could print, put in a magazine, and then it could go out to, you know, 100,000 readers and take them from a position of perhaps knowing nothing about the subject to having a grasp and understanding of the important elements, and hopefully from that take away understanding and perhaps new knowledge. Is that kind of what you were getting at? Is that a good intro then for
I think that where I was going with that and what's important to talk about is this idea of what it is, why it is you bother to write. I mean, we have a notion today that writing and in newspapers and magazines and the kind of writing that you did for years with a magazine is becoming obsolete, that it doesn't matter, that it's insignificant, that people get scraps and tidbits and pieces of data, and that's good enough. And yet you didn't just stop writing the scraps and tidbits and pieces of data. You went on to write a book. In a world where people who are in the news media in many small communities around the country feel like what they do doesn't matter, you took it to another level I mean, there's a difference in how you think about it and why you think it matters. And the question is, what was it? And why were you trying to do something that was different?
Okay. A journalist or reporter's responsibility to the community that he's writing for is really to inform and educate about current events. So the idea is you write an unbiased story that delivers the facts first, and then hopefully you put those facts into context that'll help a reader understand the significance of in my case, the aerospace news. So your job is really to translate into a common language to promote understanding. And the reporter's rule basically is to answer the five W's, the who, what, when, where, and why. And I did that for 22 years. But one of the frustrations I experienced as a reporter was, particularly in the aerospace news business, was I was talking to and informing a very small group. And the stories I was writing really had a short half-life. As one person said to me one time, said, "That was a great story you had last week, Bill. What have you done for me this week?" So at some point, I said, in order to reach a much larger audience and to help shape not just understanding of the facts, but an understanding of all those myriad elements that contributed to a story. So, for instance, that's why I came to the idea that perhaps the best way to shape a society's perceptions through media is through entertainment. So that's why I move towards fiction. You can use the same facts, but if you put them into a compelling story that is interesting, and yet it has a message, and that message can shape perception. I'll give you an example of how we came to write Space Wars, the first 6 hours of World War III, the fiction book you mentioned. I had done quite a few years of reporting, primarily with the military space community out here in Colorado Springs, but also to the contractor community. You know, and that's where I met Rick Stevens and you along the way, was writing stories about aerospace subjects. But in particular, this was a military space subject. And I found that over a period of years, as I interviewed successive generals that sat in the seat out here of what we call Commander-in-Chief of Space at that time, and Air Force Space Command commanders, et cetera, I found that I was writing the same news story over and over. And what these generals kept telling me, and they were telling Congress and others, was, in this case, we in this day and age are highly dependent on our satellites. Those satellites are vulnerable. And if we lose them, we in the Western societies, the United States in particular, are in deep trouble. However, that message was only going to the aerospace and defense community who were reading my stories in Aviation Week magazine. Those people, that audience, got it. But the larger population really didn't. That's why I decided if we put those same issues into a fiction book and through a hopefully compelling story, tell readers, what I would say average American readers, the same story by showing them what might happen if you lost that space infrastructure, if we lost our satellites. So that was the reason for writing Space Wars.
Basically, the gist of it was to take what you were already working on, what was already public knowledge, public information, and wind it, all those details and pieces of information together so that they fit within a context, so that people then had a story that they could link all these pieces of data together and give you a much more clear and lasting picture, something that they could respond to.
That's right. And as a for example, people came back after reading our book and said, "I had no idea that we were so dependent on satellites. I had no idea that every time I swiped my credit card at the pump at a gas station, that there was a very good chance the approval process went by satellite. It happened so fast, and then it said, authorized, you're clear to pump gas." And in that very short time, something had shot to a satellite, signal back down to a server somewhere that said, yes, Elaine Scott is using a good credit card. She's free to buy gas here. But there are many other things, too. So we told this story, as you said, in context, mm-hmm. and related it to people's daily lives.
So in a tech-savvy, information-overloaded world, what we were doing was we were really admitting that we don't know very much about how the infrastructure works. We just use the services and don't give a lot of thought to it. And the reason that that's important is because the value, it goes back to the value of what people are contributing in terms of stories and writers is weighed by people differently depending upon the generation that they're in. And in our next conversation, we'll talk a little bit about the different perceptions that different generations have about the value of media and the stories that they interact with. This is Elaine Scott. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our conversation. Rick and I are talking with Bill Scott, who is a published author and a writer with many, many years experience in covering people in business and industry. And Rick, you wanted to talk to Bill a little bit about your experience as you were taught to deal with media, not as someone who had a journalism background, but someone who has to answer the stories that people ask you about.
Well, thanks, Elaine. I think there's a number of things that are important, and while we all tend to think about this almost kind of naturally, I think it's important to remind our listeners that we all learn differently. You know, some of us do better with written text. Some of us do, better with, from a verbal perspective. But all in all, one of the great values about the media is when we take into account all the various elements, the audio, the visual, and package that together, we're able to be more successful getting our message across. And so in thinking about that, as you rightly point out, my training is not in the media side. I'm all about trying to run a business and be successful to be able to provide value to shareholders. But it became very important for me as I worked through my career to recognize how to use the media and to recognize, there's certain tools and techniques and properties that get that message across. Let me use an example. Elaine and I, you and I went through not too long ago when you and I saw a terrific story about brain development and a doctor was talking about schizophrenia and was walking through an example about the brain. And one of the things, I read the text, and while interesting, it was and certainly insightful, it didn't have the full impact until I actually saw the video. And when I saw the video and the doctor not only talking about her experiences, but actually holding a brain, with the spinal column, it really brought to life and be able to see not only tie in what I was hearing, but also put it visually and had, much greater impact. I know that, that one of the first discussions that we had with you, Bill, was, the interview, really about, workforce and the challenges we face going forward. And you and I spent some time actually creating a DVD, which is now on our website and has been distributed in many different locations to give people some insight, again, the visual context and perspective of what's going on, but also to hear and see the body language and really see that exchange back and forth. And I think that's the powerful element. And so as we think about, the dialogue that we're having on our show today and your notion about, facts and data, which are critically important, but being able to provide that context so people see it in a way that actually has meaning to them, I think is really the power of media we want to talk to. Not about shading the implication of the facts, but really telling the story so that people put into context, what all is going on and what they ought to go off and do. And it sounds like you've had some terrific success doing that, and as you've transitioned from being, quote, a reporter into now much more of the storyteller, and having greater impact getting your message across.
That's correct, Rick, and it actually has worked out that way. Just to reshape, perhaps, or reframe some of the things you just said there, if you can stimulate a number of human senses with a particular message, they tend to remember it better, and they tend to understand it better. So if you really can somehow use print, audio, and visuals somehow together, the message comes across and it sticks better. So one of the things we did writing a book was, as I said before, put the story in context. But I'm kind of anxious to see how somebody else will take it and put it into a movie where you stimulate those oral and visual sensors, if you will, and see how that comes across, because I think it puts everybody on the same page at that point. When I write a story, and I'm speaking a fictional story at this point, and we have 1,000 readers read that story, in essence, they've created 1,000 different mental movies, if you will, because everybody sees the characters differently. I can describe them, you know, very detailed, perhaps, but the image in your mind is going to be different than it is in my mind. So that's one of the problems that we have in trying to come up with a common language that I know you folks have been talking about for quite some time. Movies tend to put everybody into a common language, at least the language of visualization, and we're all on the same page at that point.
I think that's true, but I'm going to offer just a little sticky note, and that is that while it flattens our, you know, and kind of spreads out like a thin layer of ice, everybody's perceptions across a screen, I would not say that it is actually as filled with the same wonder, of course, as the real experience itself. What you were able to do when you were telling me the story about riding with the Blue Angels was your sensory pathways and your perception of that experience were so almost overloaded with the sheer magnitude of that experience. Now, I don't care how many pictures of movies you see about Blue Angels flying, it isn't the same as being up there in the airplane.
That's exactly right. There's absolutely no substitute for the experience itself. And I had to translate from actually being in the airplane, you know, try to describe the... It was a violent flight, you know. Every time the airplane moved, it was, in rapid fashion. You know, they were full deflection aileron rolls when they would break apart. When we would, you know, come back together, there were 7.5 G turns involved there. And when we were flying in the close diamond, you know, we're 18 inches to 3 feet apart. You know, I can count the rivets on the airplane around me or right next to me. But it's, yep. You know, I try to convey that in print, and people have seen that in movies a lot, but it's just not the same as actually having been there and experienced it. I mean, when the reader finished my story, I'll guarantee you, he wasn't near as sweaty and as pooped as I was.
Wouldn't you say there's a lot of sensibility to that, Rick? I remember when you were, for a while, you were doing part of your travel log for the people that work for you, and you were telling them where you were going week to week, and you were making an effort to use the advantage of the media to help build relationships and to help tie together a very large organization. Isn't that true?
Well, there's no question, and again, it's the, as Bill mentioned, when you bring more senses in, people see it as much more real. Not, you know, the full experience, but certainly they get a better sense about what's going on, and they're able to relate to not only you as a person, but to the facts and data that's being provided. And just a comment on Bill's comment about flying with the Blue Angels being a little bit of a violent experience, having been in a fast mover, as a midshipman. I mean, when you look at an airplane flying and the Blue Angels, it looks so smooth as they're moving along at, you know, 400 or 500 miles an hour. But when you're actually in that cockpit, it really is, you know, an aileron roll is a jerky ride as opposed to this kind of this smooth rollover. And again, it all goes back to, you know, success that we have when we use the full element of the media is being able to get a story across with the message. We evoke emotions and cause people to change their perspective, their attitude, and ultimately their behavior going forward. And I think that's the opportunity. It's also the challenge. The challenge about how do you portray it in a realistic way without trying to necessarily, you know, cause people to have the wrong impression, at the same time give them more flavor and sense so that they're actually going to really understand, and then you know, they can make their individual decisions and calls based upon, you know, how they see that with some consistency going forward.
That's exactly right, Rick. And but I always felt my job as a reporter in conveying what it was like to ride in one of those fast movers was to do my best through words, aided by a few still images, was to put that reader in the cockpit with me so that he or she felt like they were along. And then at the end of the story, they said, okay, I have a pretty good idea of what it would be like to do that.
Well, I think that that's an important, for me, that's an important point. And actually what I'm interested in, and I brought this up today, had to do with the way in which you choose which facts to focus on and which pieces of data to integrate into a story. And for so many people, the notion of having a conversation about the media is about swapping today's fact, and which becomes tomorrow's fairy tale or tomorrow's fodder for for discussion about how wrong someone was. And we're missing a kind of communication, a way to communicate. And I'm going to use a word that is very familiar to both of you called, we call them message points. And all too often, that's another problem with the way that the media deals with the media, meaning especially the reporting media, the news world. There are these people are going out talking and delivering stories, and they're giving message points. They have five things they want to say, and they say them over and over and over again. And I would like, when we come back, Rick, I want you to give me a little bit of your sense of that notion of what happens to you and what you were taught to do with message points. And the reason that that's important is that it relates to the notion of how you get really clear about what it is you want people to know about what you're doing. And for a stakeholder leader, that's a critical skill set. And we'll be right back.
This System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott, is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
This System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
This is a really an important discussion because all too often in the course of doing our radio show interviews and contacting people to talk with us, it's amazing the amount of fear, and I'm going to say a little bit of extreme sense of sensitivity about talking, and oh no, I can't do that, and I can't talk to the media. And Rick, I remember you talking a number of times about something you learned to do called message points. And I think, Bill, if you talk about it, you're talking about sound bites. And I need some help understanding, as someone who's going to be dealing with the media for the first time, I'm a new stakeholder, I'm trying to get a message out, I want my community to know about things. What do I need to know about message points?
Well, Elaine, thanks very much for asking that question. And what I like to say about message points is that one of the things we learned early on is we do focus on our message points, almost to the point of no matter what question gets asked, it's really about what is the message I'm trying to deliver.
But where do you get the message points? Where do you get them?
Well, the message points we create based upon what we're trying to deliver. And so if I get interviewed by the media, it's going to be about a particular topic. The media, the interviewer may have a particular angle they're trying to come from. I want to make sure I've got my angle I'm trying to come from about the message I'm trying to deliver. And it's that basis which allows me to go create the message points. So there's the interview is this dance back and forth about questions and response, but always staying on target. Having been in interviews before where I know a reporter or someone's after, you're really finding out some of the gut, very difficult issues with the development of a business or a particular product, and you know they've gotten some data, and you know what you're trying to do is think about not where they're trying to come from to find issues with, but rather what's the real status you want to portray. And so it is those message points about whether it's schedule, whether it's cost, or whether it's about capability. Any of those could be the form for your basis point, but typically a person talking to the media, whether they're a community stakeholder, whether they're a business leader, they have an objective for talking to the media, which is about getting their message across on their particular items. That forms the basis for message points. And when you flip it over from, you know, Bill's, you know, vantage point is he's trying to find out, you know, he's got some questions he's trying to get answers to fill out his story, because he's probably already thought about the story he wants to tell. And again, it's this dance that goes back and forth if they're not aligned or there's some issues. Bill, I'll turn it over to you.
That's exactly right, Rick. And I've been on both sides of the fence. You know, I have been interviewed, and, of course, I've been much more on the other side as a reporter. You go in to an interview with a number of questions, because obviously you're there to learn something about a subject that both you and the interviewee are focusing on. But I always tried first to not go in with preconceptions. Yes, we're talking about a certain topic, but I'm not one of these guys that writes the story first and then goes out and looks for the facts to support it. I always went in and listened to try to find what the story is here. And yes, I knew that the interviewee on your side of the table, Rick, often had the points that they wanted to make. But I didn't start there. I always started, hopefully, establishing a rapport by trying to use and settle on a common language. And in the aerospace business, I felt very comfortable there because having come from the engineering background, I was often able to use exactly the same kind of language, the technical language of an engineer or scientist or a manager in the aerospace community. That usually helped a lot. As soon as the interviewee realized that I used the same language, we could communicate better. That put him at ease or her at ease, and away we could go down the list of questions. But again, I would often follow a certain thread and say, ah, the story is down that lane. It's not the one that I thought it might be. So,
okay, but how do you do it now, Bill? How do you, as the person who's being interviewed, do you use the same technique Rick does? I mean, do you use message points? Do you have things that you just flat get out no matter what question you're asked?
No, I kind of tend to go with however the interviewer wants to go. Yes, I do have certain things to get across, just as Rick would, but you also want to, I'm in a different situation now. I don't have anything I have to defend or get a point out other than, folks, I'd like to have you read this book. So the points, I guess you'd say, are what are the main topics, the main theme of the book, and a few grabbers that hopefully somebody would say, sound interesting, maybe I'll go get that book.
What ideas or thoughts would you give to people now? You've been on both sides of the equation, and we're talking to people all the time now who are trying to learn to work with the media for the first time, and they're showing up and having been on both sides. What would be your you know, your lesson for a stakeholder leader, someone who says, I want to go make a difference, but I've got to engage the community media, what would you tell them to go do first?
I would say try to establish a relationship, because if there's a relationship, a good relationship, and a rapport, the communication follows after that. And then I
over the internet or face-to-face?
Ideally, face-to-face. And then you go down from that, you know, phone isn't as good as face-to-face. Messaging back and forth on the internet isn't as good as telephone. So you try to use the medium the best way you possibly can. But then how do you do it? You go right back to what Rick said. You know, you do make sure you try to keep the interview on the key message points, because if it's rambling, it's not going to be any good for either party.
Well, and let's just think about this discussion tonight. I mean, tonight it's all about communication and media and trying to get your point across, and certainly we thought about what it is we wanted to talk about and trying to help people understand this discussion and dialogue. We've got Bill as an expert who's on both sides of this fence and thinking about, you know, the relationships that we've had, you know, with Bill over the years, and then the message points you're trying to work across. I think this is a great example to give many people. One of these is, it just doesn't happen as getting together. It really is some thought goes into the dialogue so that it really can be productive, because it's concise, it's to the point, and it really helps the listener come up with facts, data, information, and conclusions or some insights that they didn't have before.
I will throw out a caution, though, because unfortunately, a lot of my former colleagues in the media, they often come in with an agenda, or they already have the story in their mind. So the challenge there for the interviewee, the person being interviewed, is to deftly move them over to make sure that they grasp and use the points, the message points, as Rick said, or you know, you have to reduce your message to a sound bite that will get in there somehow.
So you want to be just cautious if people have already written the story, you know, before they get in, before they have interviewed you or talked to you.
You have to be careful that if they already have their story set, you know, and television is the toughest because they only have a very few minutes to get a story across. So you, as the person being interviewed, have just a very, very few opportunities to convey your story. So you have to reduce your message down to just a few sentences. Rick can probably talk this even better than I can. But you have to say something that is quotable and that you have a pretty good idea is going to get on the evening news.
Well, let me ask you a question about the different media that you read. What do you... We've talked about all different kinds of media, and I remember having a rather fun conversation with you one time, given that you've come out of aerospace and you've come out of, you know, it's a very strict discipline of writing. And yet you, at one time, were giving me a near fascinating story about your experience with, media that were other people, you know, people on one hand would laugh at, but on the other hand would read in the grocery store line. And you were talking about why those papers exist, and that you said there's a reason and a value to them. You want to comment on that a little bit?
I think you're talking about what we would call the rags that you see at the,
yes,
the checkout,
yes,
stand.
I,
there.
I would.
And one of the fascinating things about the highly classified community, if you will, what we call the black community in aerospace. They often, and I was told this by somebody in that community, that if somebody spotted a classified airplane, the black community was extremely good at, quote, leaking a bit of information tied to that sighting to the rags. But if something about that airplane showed up wrapped within fantastic story about a UFO. So, oh my God, it's an alien, and you know, there may be a few facts in there, but if it was wrapped in the UFO package, it served a very valuable purpose. Because if it showed up in one of the rags, there was a very good possibility that I, at Aviation Week magazine, and people at the Washington Post, New York Times, Time magazine we would not pay attention to that. Why? Because it already showed up in the rag. So what a great way to hide in plain sight.
Rick, I love that story, don't you?
It's a terrific story because I think it provides a good sense about how people play the messages they want to deliver.
That's right. I think it's great. Bill, you are absolutely terrific, and I have enjoyed this interview so much. And we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Bill, one of the main reasons I enjoy talking with you has to do with the very nature of who you are and how much you give of yourself and your sense of self-security, your enthusiasm for your ability to tell a story and make a difference. But while you are a very decorated reporter, how many international outstanding reporter awards have you received in your industry?
Not sure if they all qualify as international, but 17 over my career. So,
yeah, me too. Yeah, right. I've had 17 hugs is about all I've got. I think that's wonderful. But I think what's important about what you do is you're willing to take risks. You're willing to ask questions in a way that leave people with a sense of possibility that if they tell you something, you're going to make it sound right. In the work that we're doing now, as we encourage more people to actually deal with the media in all its different forms and aspects, I'm struggling with what to tell people who are themselves reporters like yourself and don't feel good about what they do. Can you offer any thoughts or ideas that we might pass along to people who are in the industry as reporters and how they might do better or think more of themselves?
These are very challenging times for reporters, real trained journalists who went through J school, learned the right way to report and write or visually tell a story. And the main problem is because the whole media business has become what I have to call fractionated. It's just chopped up in all kinds of little pieces. And, you know, the internet is responsible for an awful lot of that. People can go to the internet, they can go to television, they can listen to the radio, they can read a magazine, they can read a newspaper, but more and more, especially the younger folks, are going online to find anything and everything they want. So that presents a challenge for the working journalists because the facts are, the statistics are that fewer people are reading newspapers, large newspapers, small newspapers, magazines, etc. So in order to grab them, you have to have something that is succinct and meaningful to them. So the journalist has to not just report the facts, but he has to sort of listen to a story again at the gut level. And there were a few times during my career that I ran into something that intuitively I knew was an absolute truth, and it was important that our Aviation Week space technology readership had this information. But it was so offbeat that the first order of business was I had to frame it. I had to reduce it to what I call the elevator speech, something that in just a few sentences I could convey to my boss, because unless I did that, he was going to say, "Bill, don't waste your time on that. That's not our story." And that's the worst thing you want to hear as a journalist. That's not our story.
But that's what you did with the work that you did with us.
That's exactly right. And believe me, it was a hard sell. It became a series in Aviation Week that was probably the most dramatic thing I did in my 22-year career, and that was a series we called Aerospace in Crisis. But the first time I wrote three stories. My boss said, "Well, I'm not sure this is anything we're interested in, but go ahead and write a story." I did, but I couldn't get it in the magazine because it wasn't, quote, breaking news. And yet it had more impact on the aerospace business long term than anything we were writing for next week's magazine.
It continues to have impact today.
It does. And the bottom line was it's exactly how Birth to Work got started. It was this big question of why are things going wrong and fewer people are interested in going into technology, science and technology subjects?
Right. It was the beginning of that whole question. It was the place that that whole issue started, and so many people talk about today, but do not recognize that it began right there, right with that story that you had the courage, not just the tools and the data, but the courage to actually pursue, because there were people who brought you stuff and said, Bill, look at this. Right?
I wrote that first story, but the only way I could get it in the magazine was to put it on the list for the big Paris Air Show issue that we do every 2 years. Well, it's a big, thick magazine, a lot thicker than our normal magazine, because Aviation Week was a weekly magazine.
Right.
So I filed that story, and my boss finally read it. And he came back and said, this is too important to bury in a big, thick issue where most people won't get all the way through it. So we held it. And then it became what we call the lead book story, the lead-off story, the top of the news, if you will, in a one of our regular issues. And he said, boy, you know, it's a long story, but we've got to get it all in, so we're going to eat up some pages. And I said, hey, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I could write at least two more right now with the information I have. So getting back to my earlier point, he said, go ahead and write those two stories, and we'll put them up on our website.
Right.
So there we had to hit the normal print magazine, but we also took this story onto the Internet, and it exploded. When those three stories hit, even though they were in two different mediums, the phone started ringing off the hook. My email box just was overflowing because it struck a chord with everybody out there. So many of our readers were living this aerospace in crisis on a day-to-day basis.
Right, and it was the basis of the workforce crisis. Yep.
That's right. And so it went from, that's not our story, to, oh my God, that is a huge story.
Right,
But for the journalists working out in the field, it's tough, number one, to identify those issues, and number two, to frame them, and then even tougher to reduce it to that elevator speech and then sell it to your editor who has an idea of what he thinks is important.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm going to just make a quick comment because I want to come back to this story. But in talking to journalists in one city, Rick and I have a book called The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, which is basically a fiction with the data and facts like you talk about in your book, real data and facts built into a story, precisely because you made that suggestion and you said, you know, I think you could tell your story with using real information in a fictional way so that you can give context and put order into, put order in that story that other people can grasp. And that has been exactly what's happened. But the bigger picture here is that what you did and what you have done is you have not been afraid to ask people you don't always talk to. I mean, I'm hardly, you know, when we first met, I was hardly someone that you had met, you know, I'm not even in the aerospace industry in any sense of the word, other than I was doing some contract work on workforce development, and you welcomed the conversation and you asked all kinds of questions. And sometimes I wonder if people don't get caught in that rut, would you say, Bill, where they just kind of keep talking to the same people and keep getting the same feedback?
Well, sure, because that's your comfort zone. And if you can, as a reporter, get out of that comfort zone a little bit, look beyond the news of the day. You know, you, coming from a different perspective, the education world primarily, you brought me several tidbits of information that turned into Aviation Week stories that fed very nicely into this aerospace and crisis.
How about the one on the brain and
that,
the impact of
The impact of light screens, you know, that was an area that you'd say, what does that have to do, that and the way the brain works, what does that have to do with aerospace?
Right.
Well, it has a lot to do with the future workers that are going to fill the factories and the laboratories and the cockpits of tomorrow's aerospace.
And did you know that last week, Newsweek magazine reported on the physical, put out by the American Physical Therapists Association on the impact of low movement activity by newborns, by small babies, and its impact on the development of children and skill sets, such that six-month-old babies coming in to see physical therapists all across the country are coming in with the physical skill sets of a two-month-old. And this low level of development at that age is equivalent to years of slowed development as children get older. Hence, this very issue of workforce development that we have been pursuing and talking about and bringing to the attention of the public is now beginning to gather enough data around this tipping point that says this is probably as big a part of that story about why kids aren't doing well as anything people have ever looked at. And I would suggest to you that framing that you taught me to do, and it was equivalent to the notion of I was talking to Rick about some airplanes, the 787s that were made of aluminum. They're made of a composite instead of aluminum. And just that change in the material meant that the entire plane had to be changed. The entire development process around that had to be changed. And that was huge. And like my relationship with you and with the work that you're doing in your book, tell us the name of both of your books now, Space Wars.
The first one is Space Wars, The First 6 Hours of World War III. And the sequel is Counter Space, The Next Hours of World War III. And I'm working on one called Black Aura.
And you've got a book and you've got a movie contract and you're good to roll. And we are out of here for today. We'll be back with Bill Scott again in the future. Thank you. Thank you. And this is Elaine Scott signing off of Birth to Work Radio. See you again next week. Bye.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.